Okay, I thought that it would be proper tonight, instead of speaking about the previous Seder, next Seder, speak about Purim and Amalek. In order to understand Purim properly, we really have to first understand Amalek and try to cover Amalek and Purim. Let's start with Amalek. Of all the enemies that we had, and we have plenty of them, and still do, Amalek is the only one that we have to annihilate, eradicate their memory, destroy them completely, remember to do that all the time. What did they do so bad to us, worse than all our other enemies, that they are singled out? So, you probably would say, because they were the first, after Kriyas Yamsu, when the whole world took notice that there's some power that is protecting the Jewish people, and were afraid to touch us, Rashi brings down the Chazal, we were like a hot boiling bath in their eyes, and nobody wanted to touch us. And Amalek jumped in, they attacked us, and showed that we're touchable, that we are vulnerable. And even though they got burned, but they cooled us off in the eyes of the other nations, and they opened the floodgates of all the other enemies to follow. So since they were the first, that's why they have this distinction of being the worst. Still doesn't answer the question, though. Because why weren't they afraid? The whole world was afraid of us, except for Amalek. They were crazy. They were crazy after Rahman the Son. They were badder than everybody else. What exactly was it about Amalek that made them ignore what the rest of the world recognized? So what I'm going to tell you, I don't have a solid source for, but it explains so many things and answers so many questions that I think it has to be true. Besides, somebody told me that Rav Huttner says something similar. Didn't have a chance to see it inside. But if so, then for sure I have at least a good partner in what I'm going to tell you. The idea is the following. What I think is that until Amalek, there were two camps in the world, two schools of thought, two philosophies. There were those that believed in God, who were basically the family of Avraham Avinu and those that he inspired and influenced. And then the rest of the world, from the generation of Enosh on, were idol worshippers. They believed in many powers that ruled the world. Wind, sky, the angels, the planets, whatever. Amalek introduced the third philosophy, atheism, belief in nothing. Amalek did not even believe in any gods. No intelligent forces that control the world, just blind evolution. That's how the world evolved, and it's run by blind forces of nature, of what's it called, politics and social and whatever. That's what runs the world. Where's the source for such a thing? The following Medrash, the way at least Reb Tzadik says it. The Medrash is in Parshas Yisro, and it's based on the Chazal that Rashi brings down, that one of the things that Yisro heard that gave him the incentive to join the Jewish people was the war with Amalek. That was one of the things that woke him up. So the Medrash says like this. It's a pasuk in Mishlei. Taka lets, hit the lets, Upesiyar Yaru, and the fool will wake up. The Medrash says, Let's is Amalek. So when you hit Amalek, when they fought against Amalek, Pesi Yarin, Pesi Zay Yisro. The fool woke up. Yisro is called the Pesi. The fool, he woke up. So that's what Yisro heard that inspired him, aroused him to come, was Melchemes Amalek. On that, Reb Tzadik from Lublin says the following. A letz is someone who believes in nothing. And a pesi is somebody who believes in everything. Excuse me. Meaning that Yisro examined and investigated every power in the world. And he believed in everything. until he came to belief in God. And Amalek believed in nothing, not even other gods. Not just they didn't believe in God, they didn't believe in anything. No belief at all, everything is just blind, happenstance, circumstance, coincidence, or whatever. If that's the case, then the answer to our question is simple. Why were Amalek different than the rest of the world? If you were an idolater, and you saw the splitting of the Red Sea, you would attribute it to some intelligent force that's protecting the Jewish people, and you'd be afraid that that force would get you. But if you're an atheist, and you attribute the splitting of the Red Sea to total accident, just, they were lucky. So why should you be afraid? The accident's going to happen again? Why? There's no reason to be afraid that anything's going to happen again. This was not planned. It wasn't directed by any intelligent force. It just was a lucky coincidence. So, lucky coincidence. That could happen again. Now, why would you ask me? You could understand that an atheist doesn't believe that the Red Sea split. He believes it's a legend. It's a myth. It didn't happen. But if an atheist saw the splitting of the Red Sea, how could you remain an atheist? How could you see a sea split, the Jews go through, the Egyptians go back, they get drowned, and attribute it to coincidence? The answer is yes. Okay? I'll prove it to you. There was a Russian Jewish scientist who lived not too long ago. His name was Emanuel Velikovsky. He wrote a few books. His main book was Worlds in Collision, which I don't suggest you read. But it's an interesting book. The book, basically, part of it, proves scientifically that the 10 plagues in Egypt occurred, that the sun stood still for Yeshua, and the Red Sea split. This Velikovsky was a very talented, intelligent scientist. He was a geologist, an astronomer, an Egyptologist, and a host of other things. Very, very smart person. He was a well-respected scientist up until the time that he wrote these books and put forth his theory. And since basically his books involved showing that the total was true, he was ostracized by the scientific community. That is not something for a scientist to do. So how did he just say this? He said he found a papyrus in hieroglyphics that reported the 10 plagues from the Egyptian side, meaning that he found this papyrus written in somebody's diary, right? Today there was blood everywhere with nothing to drink. There's frogs everywhere. There's what they're called lice, whatever it was. And this Egyptian was bemoaning all these terrible plagues that are hitting them. Other Egyptologists argue, and there's about 5 or 6 different ways of interpreting hieroglyphics. They haven't found yet a Hebrew-English hieroglyphic, dictionary. It's just conjecture. So many scientists said it was just somebody's laundry list. And as he says, it was a 10 plagues. So, okay, that's what he believed. He also claimed, as a geologist, to have studied the bed of the Red Sea and found that it had been exposed to the air at some time in its history. That means that the Red Sea split. He also said, according to the astronomical calculations of the Earth's turning on its axis, there's a discrepancy of quite a few hours, which means that at some point the Earth stopped rotating on its axis, and therefore the sun stopped in the sky. And he said he found a legend in Chinese legends that around the same time as Yeshua, there was a long night in China, which means if the Earth stopped turning, there'd be a long night. It was a long day.
Fantastic.
Now you would think, well,
fantastic.
Yeah, fantastic. You would think this guy would be a tremendous believer in God, because he not only believed these things, he actually felt that he proved them scientifically, and he put his reputation on the line, and he was ostracized and stood by it. He was an atheist. So how do you believe all these things happen? He believed they happened. So that was his theory. Worlds in collision. He believed that the planet Venus was not in its set orbit at that point in history, and it came on a collision course with the Earth a few times and came very close to colliding with the Earth, and its gravitational pull caused all the 10 plagues. And he shows how every one of the 10 plagues could have been caused by the gravitational pull of Venus. And then, a few weeks later, it came by and came so close that it pulled the Red Sea out of its bed. That was the splitting of the Red Sea. And 40 years later, it just happened to come by on the right day when Yeshua needed a longer day and stopped the earth from rotating on its axis. Now, if you believe that God performs these miracles through bringing the planet Venus close to earth, you're not an apikoros. It's not necessary, but you wouldn't be an apikoros. The Ralbag, in his Perush, many times explains a lot of these supernatural nisim that God did them through nature. That's not the miracle. I don't care how God did it. The miracle isn't how it was done. The miracle was the timing. But to think that just when the Jews needed 10 plagues to get them out of Egypt, Venus just happened to pass by. Venus is just an unintelligent piece of rock. And then just when the Jews are standing by the Red Sea, not a day earlier, a day later, not when they're in the middle of the water or whatever, Venus is there again to pull the sea out of the dead. And just when the Egyptians come through, that's when the sea goes back. And just 40 years later, to the day, just the day that Yeshua needs a long day, there's Venus again. It's absurd. So you see, though, a person who's an atheist can believe in Kriyas Yamsuf and still believe that it was an accident. And that was Amalek. They saw it. They attributed it to total blind forces, and therefore there's nothing to be afraid of. And that's why Chazal say, Reishis Goyim Amalek, it's a pasuk. Amalek are called the Reishis, the beginning. And we're also called Reishis. The way I like to understand that is the following. You ever play tug of war? Two teams, one on one end of a rope, one on the other end. The two ends are Amalek and the Jewish people. We believe in God, they believe in nothing. In the middle is the rest of the world who believe in idolatry, other powers. We're trying to pull the world from idolatry to belief in God, and they're trying to pull the world from idolatry to atheism. And that's a struggle that goes on for all generations between us and Amalek. That's why Amalek in Gematria is suffix, doubt. Because if you wouldn't know that there's an alternative explanation to creation, the only thing you would know is Bereshis Bara Elokim. There'd be no other option. You would never have heard of evolution. Then your emuna in the creation of the world would be stronger. The fact that we all know that there is another alternative puts doubts in our mind. Well, you know, there's respectable, intelligent people believe in that. So, who knows? So, you still believe, but not as strongly as if you didn't know there was another option. So, Amalek puts doubts in our mind. Not only that, whenever Amalek is stronger than their atheism, it weakens us. And when we're weak in our belief, it strengthens them. And the opposite is also true. And therefore, the first time we were vulnerable to Amalek is when we questioned, Hayesh Hashem b'kirbeinu imayim, we repeated, we needed some water to drink, there was no water in the desert, and we said, is God going to give us water, is he with us or not? Now what was the question? God's with them. At night they had a pillar of fire that accompanied them, in the daytime they had a cloud, they saw the splitting of the Red Sea, they saw the 10 plagues, they were taken out of Egypt, what was the question if God was with them? So the Mepharshim explained, they thought maybe God only gets involved with the spectaculars. God's there when you need to split a sea. But when it comes to getting a drink of water, God gave over the world to the powers of nature. And that's it. And it's just, it goes on by the Shabbos clock. Nature. That's what they thought. When we're not sure that God is involved in nature, then we're vulnerable to Amalek, who doesn't believe that God's involved in miracles either. Therefore, Chazal say that as long as Amalek is in the world, the effect on how we see God's presence in the world is mitigated. It's weakened. And therefore, the pasuk says, Ki yod al keis ka. Rashi learns God picked up his hand in an oath over his throne, and he swore to wage war with Amalek from generation to generation. But the pasuk, when it speaks about the kisei, the throne, it doesn't say kisei. It says case. It reduces it to two letters instead of three. Instead of chaf samach aleph, it's chaf samach, case. And God's name isn't the complete name, yud kei vav kei. but only Yud and Hey. So the rabbis learn, as long as Amalek is in the world, God's throne is incomplete, and his name is incomplete. But Ki Yod Al Teis Ka, Milchomo Lashem Ba'amalek Nidor Dor. It's the last pasuk in Parshas speech, Rishala. What does it mean? So there are many very deep meanings. I'll tell you what I think it means simply. Kisei Hashem, God's throne, is a euphemism for God's control of the world. Hashgachas Hashem. That's not my understanding. That's well known. That when it speaks about God's throne, it doesn't mean God sits on a throne. It means just like when a king sits on his throne, his kingdom is settled and he's in control. God's control of the universe is represented by his throne. However, if you don't see the king on the throne, you see an empty throne, then you have doubts. Maybe the king's not around. Maybe he never was a king. Maybe there's anarchy. So as long as Amalek is in the world, the Aleph is missing from the Kisei. The Aleph represents God. So what's left? Case. Case means hidden. Obscure. You can't see God's control of the world. It looks like politics, social, economic things rule the world. That's how it looks. Through the influence of Amalek. And God's name is incomplete. The simplest understanding of Yud Kei Vav Kei, aside from the fact that it means that God brought everything into existence, it also means that he transcends time. Haya, Hove, Yehiye. Was, is, and always will be, which means since time is part of creation, God had to exist before time. He created time. Because if he existed within time, then he was existing after creation. So God created everything, including time, and therefore he transcends time. He was, is, and always will be. Past, present, future. If you take the name and split it into two, Yud and He on one side, and Vav and He on the other side, the letters Yud and He can make the words Hoya and Yehiyeh. You just have to duplicate them. You don't have to use any other letters. But they can't make Hoveh the present. Vav and Hey can make Hoveh present, but not Hoya and Yehiyeh. That means the first half of God's name represents the past and the future. As long as Amalek is in the world, you can still see God in the past. Look at the Torah. You'll see what happened in the past. You can still see God in the future. Look at the Navi. You'll see what's going to happen in the future. You know where it's hard to see God? In the present. Because in the present, everything is clouded. So the Vav and Hey, the present, is missing from God's name. The Aleph is off the Kisei, and the Vav Hey is missing from God's name. Says the Vilna Gaon and others, that's only when there is no Beis HaMikdash. But even if Amalek is in the world, but the Beis HaMikdash exists, surely when the third Beis HaMikdash will be, Amalek's influence is mitigated. Because there were 10 miracles that happened in the Beis HaMikdash every day. And you felt God's presence. So the influence of Amalek to put doubts is canceled out by the influence of the Beis HaMikdash. They cancel each other out. And then those three letters that are missing from God's throne, the Aleph, and the two letters from God's name, the Vav and the Hey, come back into the world. Where do we see that hinted to? We say a pasuk that we say every day in Pesukei Nezimra. Ki bochar Hashem b'tzion, God chose Tzion, the Beis HaMikdash, Eva l'moshav lo. He desired it to be the place he would dwell. The word Eva is Aleph, Vav, Hey. Those are the letters that are missing from God's throne and God's name. So that is Amalek. Okay. Now, let's discuss a little bit more about Amalek and the difference between idolatry and atheism. First of all, which is worse? To be an atheist or an idolater? So the Marsha and Sanhedrin says clearly, atheism is worse than idolatry. Atheism believe in nothing. Idolaters at least believe in some intelligent powers that run the world. So what makes that better? First of all, you can come to belief from idolatry. You can use it as a stepping stone. If I believe already there are intelligent powers, it's just one step further to say that there must be one original power that created all those powers. And there are people in history who have done that. Avraham Avinu was one. He came to belief in God through idolatry. Yisro was another one. And that's what Yisro said. Atta yadati Ki gadol Hashem mikol Elohim. It's normally translated, now I know God is greater than all the other powers. Big deal. That's what you know? Doesn't mean that, I don't think. Atu yodati, now I know ki gadol Hashem, that God is great. How do I know it? Mikol Elohim. From my investigation of all the other powers in the world, I've come to the conclusion that there's one God. So that's one difference. Second difference is that idolatry can be looked upon as a pseudo-belief in God. How so? The Maggid Mivilna asks the following question. It says, Mizrach Shemesh Ad Mavoah Mehulah Shem Hashem. From east to west, God's name is being praised. This is what he's talking about. From east to west, there's all these idolaters. We're the only ones who are praising God. We don't exist from east to west, what does it mean? He says, what it means is the following. Tell the story. So there was once somebody who was sick for honor. He couldn't get enough honor. So he devised a plan how he could get the most honor anybody could get. He forged Russian state stationery, wrote a letter to an outlying province somewhere in Siberia that the Tsar was coming to visit that province in 2 weeks and they should make a royal welcome. He got dressed up as a Tsar. In 2 weeks he visited this city and they gave him the coveted of the Tsar. And they proclaimed, what's it called, the long live the Tsar, and we're your servants, and they gave him flowers and made a whole banquet for it. And he went away, he finally got the coveted that he was craving. The Tsar heard about it, and he came with his armies to destroy the city for rebellion, for pledging allegiance to somebody, an imposter. So before he unleashed his troops against the city, the mayor of the city said, give me my something to say, last words. He said, when we said, long live the Tsar, we thought it was you. All the covet we gave him because we thought he was you. We didn't know what you looked like. We thought he was you. You're going to give us, you're going to destroy us because we gave you honor? Okay, true, we gave it to somebody who wasn't you, but we didn't know it wasn't you. We thought it was you. We meant you. So too, the idol worshippers of the world, when they, worship their idols, who do they mean? The one who created heaven and earth and controls it. So they just got them mixed up with these other powers. But who do they mean? God. So therefore, from east to west, God's name is being praised, except they got the wrong one. They got the imposter. So the Jews can't use that excuse because it only works for a province that never saw the Tsar. But if you ever saw the Tsar, then you know who he is. You can't claim, well, I thought the imposter was you. You know what I look like. We met the Rabbonim from face to face at Har Sinai, Kibiyah. We know who God is. We can't claim that we thought the imposter was. So it doesn't work for us, but it works for the rest of the world. Okay, in any case.
Whose story is that?
Well, the Maggid Mivilna. So, they watch the call. So that is a second difference. Not only can you come to belief from idolatry, you'll never come to belief from atheism. You can renounce your atheism and be a believer. But atheism is not a stepping stone to belief. It's the antithesis. And in a certain way, idolatry is a pseudo-belief. But atheism is the antithesis of belief. Third difference. An atheist has no moral code. Can't exist. Why? Because if everything came by accident, accident by its nature is purposeless. There's no purpose, there's no intelligence. Something that came by accident can't be good, bad, indifferent. It just is. Good, bad means there's intelligence. There's something that designated, this is what I want, this is good. This is what I don't want, this is bad. But if everything is just an accident, there can't be good, bad, there can't be any morals, no right, no wrong, everything's just an accident. The only morals that can exist are situational ethics, practical ethics. Don't step on my toes because I'll step on your toes and the world can't exist. So you keep off my toes, I'll keep you. There's nothing wrong with stepping on toes because toes are accidents. They just evolved accidentally. There can't be anything wrong with stepping on an ant because it evolved accidentally. It's an accident. What could be wrong with stepping on it? And therefore there can't be anything wrong with stepping on your aunt from Chicago either, because she's a bigger accident. Right? She came with more accidents. So, there can't be morals in an atheistic society, except practical morals. You give me space, I'll give you space. But if I can step on your toes and you can't step on my toes, then why shouldn't I step on your toes? But idolaters believe in intelligent forces. So they believe there's a right, a wrong, a good, a bad. They may distort it and get it completely backwards. Make right wrong and wrong right. But they believe in right and wrong. There is some kind of moral code to this world. The third difference, based on this, is how they look at the Jewish people. What makes us special? We are special. Why are we special? Because we are the smartest people in the world. Not true. There were very smart people who weren't Jewish. Plato, Aristotle were very smart people. They were not Jewish. We're the richest people in the world. Not true. Bill Gates and Warren Buffett have not yet converted, and they're not Jewish. And they're pretty rich, especially all the Arabs with their oil money are not Jewish. So we're not the richest people. We're the most numerous people. The Chinese have us beat by a few thousand times, or hundreds of thousands of times. So what makes us special? Torah tells us what makes us special. Two things. One is, Ni goy gadol. We have a special relationship with God that He always comes through for us in the end. Jews suffered. Many Jews died. The Holocaust in Mitzrayim, 4/5 of the people didn't make it out. But in the end, we survived. And we survived Egypt, and we survived Germany, and Spain, and Babel, and Madai, and Parash, and Mark Twain, amongst others, said that one of the biggest miracles of history is the Jewish people. Everybody's been trying to do us in, and we're still around. And the people who tried to do us in are no longer here. It's a miracle. That's one of the biggest miracles of history. That's what makes us special. We have a special relationship with God, and our being around proves it. Second greatness, the Torah says, Ni goy gadol asher lo chukim u'mishpatim tzadikim k'chol ha'Torah azol sasher anochi nosei mipneichem hayom. What nation has such a great Torah, book of laws, that govern every aspect of life, speech and action and thought and politics and social and married and eating and everything? And the Goyim recognize that too. It's a book of books. Right? They recognize the Bible as something special. And they believe in a good portion of it. They just add to it, distort it, instead of, they believe in Avraham Avinu, and they believe he was tested, and except they change Akedus Yitzchak to Akedus Yishmael. Okay? So they distort it. The Christians believe in the Old Testament, they just add on the New Testament. I once had a woman come to me in Miami. She wanted to convert. So the first question I ask a person tells me she wants to, or he or she wants to convert, what religion are you now? And why aren't you happy with the religion you're in? Why do you want to become Jewish? So she said, I'm Catholic, and the Catholic religion forces me to believe in things I just can't swallow. I just can't accept. So I assume she's talking about the fact that a man could be God, that there was immaculate conception. So I said to her, could you give me one example of something that the Catholic religion forces you to believe in that you just can't accept? She said, yes, the splitting of the Red Sea. I said, I hate to tell you this, but we were the ones who went through the Red Sea. She said, you guys believe in that too? I said, yeah. And I said, besides that, you should know the Muslims also believe in it, so don't try to become a Muslim. So she just walked out of my office disillusioned. But they believe it too.
That's true.
Right? What?
That's a true story.
True story. So that was the shortest gayrus that I ever had. In any case, so they believe in it too. They believe that the Bible is the book of books. Those are the two things that make us special. Now, if you're an idolater, you may not like these two things, but you accept the fact that they exist. There is a possibility of getting close to some power. You believe in gods, intelligent gods, you could have the favor of a god. And the Jewish people must have the favor of some power. You may not believe it's God, because we're still around. So you have to accept that as a fact. You may not like it, you may resent it, you may want to try to change it, but that's a fact. Also, you believe in a moral code. So the Torah is something that you, it's a book of books. I mean, I believe in it, may think it's changed, it's archaic, but I have to realize it is something special. If you're an atheist, though, both of these things are meaningless. You can't get close to a God, it doesn't exist. So I, the Jewish people around, okay, it's luck. Can't be explained, just coincidence. And what's it called? The fact that we have a moral code, there's no such thing as a moral code. There's no right, wrong, so the whole thing doesn't make any sense. There's no such thing as a Bible. It's absurd, according to an atheist. Therefore, if you're an idol worshiper, you have to take into consideration that the Jewish people are something, but you may not like them. You may resent them, you may be jealous of them, you may hate what they represent, but you'll do it because there's something you don't like. If you're an atheist, the Jewish people are nothing. And you don't like them because that nothing thinks they're something. And that's the difference between Haman, the Amaleki, and Ahasuerus, the idol worshiper. The Medrash says like this, Gemara says, what can it be compared to? When Haman offered Ahasuerus 10,000 talents of silver for rights to destroy the Jewish people, Ahasuerus said, keep your money and do what you want. What could it be compared to? A guy had a big hole in his field, and he was looking for landfill to fill it up. Another guy had a big mound in his field, he was looking for somebody to take it away. Finally, one day, the guy with the hole in the ground passes by the field of the guy with the big mound of earth, and he knocks on his door, he says, listen, could you sell me that mound of earth? I could use it to fill up the hole in my yard. He says, sell it to you, I'm looking for somebody to take it away for free, just take it. But what's the difference? In Ahasuerus' mind, we were a big mound of earth. And we bothered him. That mound of earth bothered him. So he wanted to get rid of us. But in Haman, the Amaleki's mind, we were a big hole in the ground. We were nothing. And he wanted to get rid of that nothing. So Amalek makes nothing of us. And that's why we have a mitzvah to make nothing of them. And the rest of the world considers us something, but don't like that something. Not everybody, but the ones that don't like us because we're something. The Amalekim don't like us because we're nothing and we think we're something. That's the difference. Okay, next. One more thing to discuss. Why Amalek became the first atheists? Why did they make this new philosophy? So, we will psychoanalyze them, and to do that, you have to go back to the parents. Who were the parents of Amalek? His mother's name was Timna, and his father's name was Eliphaz ben Esav, Esav's son Eliphaz. Timna, when she was a young lady, wanted very much to join the Jewish people. So she came to Avraham Avinu and begged him to accept her into the clan, and he rejected her completely. She came at midlife to Yitzchak Avinu, tried again, he rejected her. Came later in life to Yaakov and he rejected her. And Chazal say they did the wrong thing. You don't ever push somebody away with both hands. You bring them close with the right hand and push them away with the left hand. That doesn't mean they should have accepted her. They probably saw the seeds of Amalek in her. They couldn't accept her, but at least don't reject her completely. Talk to her nicely, explain to her, right? Give her, you know, something, a souvenir, whatever. Just don't completely reject somebody. The Gemara says, it never works. Elisha rejected Gehazi, nothing good came from it. And Yeshua ben Prakhe rejected Yashka, the founder of Christianity, and that's why he went and founded Christianity. Because he was rejected completely. No time now to go into the thing. Someday may I play them the uncensored version of the Gemara. In any case. So, she said, you know, I can't get into the front door in this family. I would rather get through the back door of this family and be a concubine to Eliphaz ben Esav than be a princess somewhere else. So she became a concubine, a Pilegesh, to Eliphaz ben Esav. That's the mother of Amalek. Father was Eliphaz. Now let's see. If your mother was rejected by the Jewish people, what is the knee-jerk reaction, reflex reaction to rejection?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and not more than that. Sour grapes. Okay? Youngster going out, this girl goes out with a guy, and wow, he's really special, and she's hoping he'll say yes. The shotgun says, he's not interested. So, originally she's hurt. But then, She said, you know what? Who was he anyway? He was dumb, ugly. I never really was interested in him at all. So who rejected me? Nobody. Because if he was somebody special and he rejected me, then there's something wrong with me. So the natural tendency when you're rejected by somebody is to have sour grapes and say, well, who are they anyway? So if your mother was rejected by the Jewish people, you would have a psychological need to make nothing of the Jewish people. Because if they're something, then somebody rejected my mother. But if they're nothing, so what? So they needed a philosophy that would make nothing of the Jewish people. That's atheism. And if you don't believe that there's any intelligent forces governing the world, then what does control the world? Might. Power. Survival of the fittest. That is what controls who survives and who doesn't. Who's stronger? Strength can be brute strength, the sword, or it could be money, power. Esav believed that you live by the sword, and whoever has the might has the right. His son Eliphaz was more respectable, refined. He believed that money controlled the world. How do I know it's his name? Eliphaz. My God is gold. And when his father told him to kill Yaakov, he didn't want to kill him. So what did he do? He took away his money. Because he held taking away somebody's money. He was tantamount to killing them. My father kills people. I just take away the money. So, therefore, Amalek devised this new school of thought of atheism because it fit the needs because of their father and their mother. Okay. In any case. Now let's apply this to Purim. We said whenever the Jews have doubts whether God is in control, we're vulnerable to Amalek. That's what happened before Purim. We were in Gaulis. God just exiled us into Babel, and the people thought that God abandoned us. He rejected us. He no longer is involved with us. And he left us over to the powers of the world. And it says in another that they thought that God divorced them, and all these euphemisms for total abandonment. And therefore, when they were faced with the following choice, to bow down to the idol of Nebuchadnezzar or not, they made the following choice. If we bow down to this idol, we'll be good in the eyes of Nebuchadnezzar, but bad in the eyes of God. If we don't bow down, we'll be good in the eyes of God, but bad in the eyes of Nebuchadnezzar. Who is more significant at this point? Nebuchadnezzar is because God's abandoned us. And therefore, we are at the mercy of powerful people. And he's powerful. So we better get in his good graces. Forget about the Ribbono Shel Olam. So they bowed to the pestle of Nebuchadnezzar. That was the first sin that brought about Haman. Why? Because they weren't sure that God was involved. They figured God abandoned them. He's not involved with them anymore. When we're not sure that God's involved, we're at the mercy of Amalek, who doesn't believe there's a God altogether. And the second sin was a result of that first sin. If you don't believe that God is involved in you, with you, then comes the second sin. Nehenu misudas Achashverosh. They enjoyed the banquet of Achashverosh. Now, according to this, the sin was not that they went. They had to go to the party. Achashverosh invites you, you go. Because if you don't accept Achashverosh's invitation, what happened to Vashti happens to you. You don't accept any more invitations off of your head. Right? So they had to go. It's Pikuach Nefesh. And it could be that the party was Gulat Kosher, according to some Midrashim. And not only that, Mordechai was at the party. He was a waiter. Says, Latzos Kirtzoni Shvish, the Midrash says. So everybody was there, and they had to be there, and no problem going. What was the problem?
Enjoyed.
They enjoyed it. What was the problem of enjoying it? You're there already, enjoyed it. No. You know what the party was celebrating? The downfall of the Jewish people. Achashverosh made a calculation, the 70 years of Golus Babel were over. The Navi said they would be redeemed after 70 years, and they were redeemed. That's it, they're finished. So he brought out all the clothing of the base of the Kohen Gadol, and that fits with this coming with Sedra, so he did something for the Sedra. And he brought out the Kalim of the Beis HaMikdash, and he celebrated the downfall of the Jewish people. And they had to be there, and they enjoyed it. Now, how in the world can you enjoy a party that's celebrating your downfall? The answer is, if you don't think that God's involved with you, then you have no importance. Amalek says you're nobody. So what makes me somebody? I rub shoulders with important people, with powerful people, because they're the ones who run the world. So they enjoyed being in Ahasuerus' party because we get to rub shoulders with powerful people. And if you don't think that's true, remember years ago how many Chevrei Knesset, who also don't believe in anything, ran to shake hands with Arafat? Right? How in the world shake hands with a guy whose hands are so full of blood? But he's powerful. And, you know, we get our covered by rubbing shoulders with these powerful people, even though they're celebrating our disruption. But if you're a self-hating Jew, because you don't believe you have any importance altogether, your importance comes from being, you know, together with the powerful people of the world. And Arafat at that time, in the eyes of the world, is a powerful person. In any case, so because we weren't sure that God was with us, well, we're pretty sure he wasn't, and because of that, we lost our self-respect. We didn't think it was important at all, and we enjoyed the Suga of Ahasuerus. Therefore, we were vulnerable to the designs of Haman. And because Mordechai didn't bow down to him, so he should have just taken care of Mordechai. But since he was an Amaleki, and he didn't consider the Jewish people at all important, it's like killing one cockroach. It's just beneath my dignity. It's a chance. But Yves Esbeino, right? It was beneath him to deal with one Jew. So destroy them all. They're all worthless. And he said, I'm not going to destroy you and be afraid that some power is going to protect you, because there's no power to protect you. You're completely hefker. And therefore, I'm going to choose the day to destroy you by a lot. Just chance. Because it doesn't bother me. I'm the one in power. It will take another week, 2 weeks, 11 months. What difference does it make? And that's what it says. He peeled poor who had goro. Simple meaning is, he cast a poor. And if you don't know what the word poor means, in Hebrew it means a goro. So some learn. Poor is a Persian word. In Haman's language, he cast a poor. But you're not Persian, so you wouldn't know what that is. So we translate it, for in Hebrew, it's a goral. It's a lot. That's good. According to those opinions, they say that poor is a Persian word. But it still has a question on it. Because it says the same thing again in the ninth paragraph. The he peeled poor who are goral. Already translated once in the Megillah. Why is it translated again? The people who wrote the Megillah, the Anshik Nesak Golah, thought we were feeble-minded. We forget what poor meant by the time we got to the ninth paragraph. Look back in the third paragraph, it says what it is. According to other Rishonim, poor is a Hebrew word. And it comes from the word pirurim, crumbs. So if that's the case, why do I have to translate? And if it's an archaic word, and the more common word was goral, then just use goral. I understand you have to use the word poor if it tells you what Haman called it. But if it's just another Hebrew word, and it's not in usage, use the word that's in usage. It's not a thesaurus, just tell me, eat the goral. Therefore, I think it's not a translation, but it means the following. He peeled poor. He decided to destroy us and choose the date by total coincidence. And he said, with that, Hu Hagorol, that's your destiny. You think you have a destiny, there's a God. Nah, not true. Your destiny is just the throw of a dice. And I'm the one who's powerful, and I can destroy you anytime I want, and it doesn't make a difference. Hu Hagorol, in fact, the word Hu is which letters? Hey, Vav, Aleph. Those are the three letters that are missing from God's name and God's throne. And they're backwards. Instead of Aleph, Vav, Hey, they're Hey, Vav, Aleph. Mm-hmm. Right? Backwards. Which means that by saying that, he wanted to uproot these letters from the world. Take away the Hey, the Vav, and the Aleph, and uproot them, turn them upside down. And what was the miracle? The Nahapo, Hu. The word Hu turned around back to be Aleph, Vav, Hey, instead of Hey, Vav, Aleph. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's just cute. Now we'll go through more, something more. In any case, so when the Jewish people were threatened with destruction, they started to do tshuva. And they started to pray to the God they weren't sure was around anymore. So they did tshuva, and they started to fast and to pray. And also it says, and hesped. They start to say eulogies. When they say eulogies, nobody died yet. The answer is they were eulogizing themselves and saying, you know what, if God is still around and he's listening to our prayers, then we're special people. And it would be such a shame if these special people were annihilated. So they started to eulogize themselves. And that was the kapara for the two sins. They prayed to gods, meaning we don't believe anymore that God abandoned us, and they thought themselves important. And Mordecai and Esther atoned for those two sins. Mordecai atoned for the sin that they bowed to the pestle of Nebuchadnezzar by not bowing to Haman. He made the exact opposite judgment. Haman, if I bow to him, I'll be good in his eyes, but I won't be good in God's eyes. So who's more significant? God, not Haman. They made the Nebuchadnezzar is more significant. To mechaper on that, Haman and Mordecai didn't bow. And Esther was mechaper on the sin of joining the party of Achashverosh. She did more than rub shoulders with Achashverosh. She was his wife. She was the queen of Persia. So she should have gotten all the covet from that. Wow, I got to be the queen of Persia. But she didn't. How did she look at it? Tashir avadati, avadati. I'm lost. My covet is being a Jewish mother, a Jewish wife, a Jewish woman, not being the queen of Persia. That's my destruction. So she, and also, in order to atone for enjoying the party, she made them fast for 3 days and three nights. They were at the party for 7 days. This is, right, 7 days of straight, day and night, is like 6 full days. In any case, so therefore, what was the miracle? What did the miracle show? That Haman's belief in total chance, accident, poor, that accident showed that God's still behind it. Even where it looks like an accident, Haman's poor turned to our poor. That's what we call it, poor. Purim seems to be a side a detail in the story. Why is that the title? Because that's the main thing. The poor, that which appears to be coincidence, accident, chance, still God's behind the scenes. And that is the message of Purim. It says in Shoshana Siakov. Shoshana Siakov means the simple meaning is the Jews of Shushan. Shoshana Siakov. But Shoshana is a rose or a lily. And in Shir Shirim, it compares us to a rose amongst the thorns when we're in Golus. We stand out amongst the nations of the world. We're like a rose amongst the thorns. And we're on the low level of Yaakov, not Yisrael, who's in charge. We're persecuted. We're Yaakov. We're on the heel. We're holding on to the heel of Esau. So I love Samecha, yet there was reason to be happy, even in those circumstances. Birosam Yachad Tchelus Mordechai, when they saw the Tchelus, meaning the miracle, that instead of being destroyed, Mordechai was raised and honored with the clothing of the king. So they saw that there must be a God behind the scenes doing all this. Besides the fact that Tchelus is always a sign of the sea, and the sea is like the sky, and the sky is like God's throne. It shows God's involvement in the world. So they saw from the miracle that happened that God's still involved. They saw God's throne, his connection to the world. To Asam HaYisrael, and that taught us the first lesson of Purim. God has a plan. He created the world intelligently, and eventually we will be saved. That's in the eternal picture. But in every generation we don't see that. We see sometimes that we're persecuted. We're not saved. But tikvasam b'chol dor, we have hope in every generation. We may not see the salvation, but we have hope because we know that God never abandons us. He's always there, behind the scenes. And therefore, Lahodira teaches me the second lesson. If God is always there behind the scenes, then we're important people. We have nothing to be embarrassed about. We can be proud of being Jews because we have a special connection to God. And lo yikomu lanetzach, even though we will be insulted by the nations of the world, not what's it called, short term, but not forever. Lo yikomu lanetzach. We have nothing ever to be embarrassed about of ourselves. We should be proud. We will be insulted, but not long term, only short term. And therefore there's good, there's bad, there's what to be cursed, what to bless, because there's a moral system in this world. Because there's a God who's concerned, who doesn't just leave it after. That's the lesson of Purim. And that's the mitzvahs of Purim. The mitzvahs of Purim are Megillas Esther, which takes 12 years of Persian history, chooses an event from this year, puts them together, and you see God's hand. If you would just look at it as 12 years of history, you wouldn't see that God is behind the scenes. But if you take those things and put them on this timeline together, You see, it can't be a coincidence. There's too much here to be a coincidence. You see God's hand. And that's why it's called Megillas Esther. It's Megala HaHester. It uncovers God's hidden hand in history. That's one mitzvah. Once you have that mitzvah, that God is involved, that means that we are important. If we're important, and you consider yourself important, you want to promote your existence. What's the simplest way to promote your existence? Eat. This is a mitzvah to eat on Purim. Suda's Purim. In fact, they say that people who are anorexic have a death wish. They don't believe they're important enough to continue living, so they want to starve themselves to death. Because I'm not important. It's one of the causes of anorexia. So if you eat, you can take this to the extreme too and overeat, but the mice, if you eat, you show you consider yourself important. I want to feed myself. I want to promote myself. Make a little bit more of me. And I'm not important because I'm needy. I'm important because I'm a Jew. Give your neighbor to eat too. Mishloach manos. Give him some food. And it's not just us who are smart and rich, and that's why we're important. We're important because we're Jews. Give the Evyon. Even the poor person has nothing except he's Jewish. Give him to eat too. Give him a present. Show that he's important too. So the mitzvahs show that we believe that God is involved. That's Megillas Esther. And that because of that, we're important. So we eat. We give others to eat. We give a present even to the person who has nothing. But he has something. He's a Jew. That is the mitzvahs and the lesson of Purim. And to put it all into four letters. The Purim that we celebrate in Netanya, in Moshav Matityahu, not in Yerushalayim, is on the 14th day of Nisan. According to our calendar setup, the 14th day of Nisan can only fall on 4 days of the week. The 14th day of Adar. The 14th day of Adar can only fall on 4 days of the week. It can never fall on Shabbos, the 14th day of Adar. It can never fall on Wednesday. Right? It can never fall on Wednesday. And it can never fall on Monday. Monday, Wednesday, and Shabbos never can be Purim. Purim can be, therefore, Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. This year is Thursday. Right? But it could be Friday, some years. And it could be Sunday, many years. Mostly Shabbos starts Purim. And Tuesday.
Why
is that? Because it works out calculation-wise that Yom Kippur shouldn't fall before or after Shabbos, and Hoshana Rabbah shouldn't fall on Shabbos, and therefore there's a calculation, and that's how it works out. But that's the Matzias. If you take the letters that represent these days of the week, Sunday is Aleph, Friday, Vav, Thursday, Hey. Those are the three letters that are missing from God's throne and God's name. Aleph, Vav, and Hey. There's only one problem. There's one more day. Tuesday. Tuesday is what? Gimel. Put the Gimel in front of the Aleph, Vav, Hey. What do you get?
Gava.
That's our pride. We believe that God's involved in the world. The Aleph, the Vav, and the Hey. And if that's the case, then that's our Gava. That's our pride that we're important people. And that's the two lessons of Purim, represented by the days that Purim falls, Gimel, Aleph, Vav, and Hey. Those 4 days of the week. Okay. Very important.
Happy Purim, everybody. And sure. Bear in mind, March 15th and 27th.